Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Sunday is November 11th, Veterans Day, and the 100th anniversary of the armistice which ended fighting in World War I at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of the year. In honor of Veterans Day, we're focusing on the poetry and music of World War I with an eye toward the days leading up to the armistice. Joining us is pianist Jacqueline Schwab. Welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Also with us is historian Gregory Williams. Good to have you back as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So each year you collaborate on a program that you've titled Battle Lines, Poetry and Music of World War I and II. And last year, listeners might remember, we had you on to discuss some of the works composed during World War I. So what was the inspiration for putting together this year's program?
Well, the original impetus, if you will, for the program was that I simply really always liked the English poets of World War I and wanted to get their works out there a little bit more to the public than just having people pick up the books. And I met Jacqueline the year before we did the first one, and it just seemed to me a perfect idea to have my imperfect reading of the poems be overshadowed by the brilliance of her playing, because Jacqueline is so well known for being able to evoke a particular historical era. And I just thought this would be perfect, and she eventually agreed, and we took it from there.
I was honored to be part of your, to collaborate with you.
He said eventually. I don't think it really took you that long, did it?
No,
it
was,
he didn't
it was,
have
it was
to twist my arm very hard.
All right, so Greg, refresh our World War history memory. What were some of the events that led up to the armistice?
Well, the war was a pretty static affair once it got going, especially even by the first winter, which was the winter of 1914-1915. But then the United States joined the war rather late. We tend to think of ourselves perhaps as being in it the whole time. We were not. There weren't any combat troops from the United States until very late in the war. But once the influx of American troops and materiel hit Europe, it started to come apart for, and I'm going to concentrate on the Western Front, the Germans. And eventually they saw the writing on the wall. They wanted to sort of negotiate an end to the war. They wanted to have an armistice, which is not technically the end of the war. It's the end of the fighting. And a few days, I think it was November 11th, some emissaries were sent into the French lines to discuss the terms of the armistice. They were taken to a forest outside Paris, and they were met there by the commander of the Allied forces, Ferdinand Foch, who essentially said to them, "We're not negotiating anything. Here's what you're going to do. Here are our demands, and essentially going to take the blame for this whole thing, and you're going to give up all of your arms." And that's pretty much what happened.
How much advance warning of the timeline were soldiers given, and how was the word spread?
Well, once that started, those talks, if you will, to the extent they were talks, began at the end of the first week of November, pardon me, the rumors started to circulate that it looked like the Germans were going to seek an armistice. So it was in the air, but the formal word didn't really get out until the day of. On November 11th, the armistice was signed at about 5:10, I think it was, in the morning. They backclocked it to 5 o'clock just so it would be even, and they said it would take effect at 11 a.m. So the word started to spread. There was radio transmission from the Eiffel Tower. There was telegraphy, obviously. The commanders started to find out about it. And then the word kind of filtered down through messengers going out to units on motorcycles and then horses and then on foot. So it certainly wouldn't have been like that now. There would have been a much more immediate effect. Back then, it took time for this to unroll. And in fact, keep in mind that it wasn't just the Western Front. There was fighting all over the place, including East Africa. They didn't find out about it for almost 2 weeks.
Mm. It must have been surreal for those on the battlefield to get word of the time frame for the fighting to stop. So describe how the news of the armistice was received in the battlefield.
Well, a lot of people, there were different reactions because they were different people. But a number of the writings that talk about the way the word was received by the fighting soldiers on the line was that they were sort of emotionally flat about it. There wasn't a great jubilation. it came as almost sort of an anticlimax to them. It's finally over. They thought they were going to be fighting into the 1950s, I think, some of them. In fact, there were songs and jokes about that. But it's over. It's over. Yeah. Finally over.
Thomas Hardy was an English novelist, but also a poet. And he wrote a poem about the armistice titled, "And There Was a Great Calm." Now, before you share the poem, can you tell us a little bit more about Thomas Hardy and what we know about the creation of this poem?
Thomas Hardy, as you pointed out, is usually regarded as a novelist. Many of his great novels came out in the 19th century, Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Jude the Obscure, that everybody has to read when they're in junior high or high school. So a lot of people don't think of him as being of this era. And indeed, when he wrote this poem, he was 78 years old. He lived for another 10 years until 1928. But he had written and considered himself a poet foremost, and had written poems. There's a sort of a long verse play that he wrote called The Dynasts, which is ostensibly about the Napoleonic Wars, but has general application. And so when he learned that this war was finally over, he wrote this poem. As you said, it's entitled, "And There Was a Great Calm." And the subtitle of it is, very direct, "On the Signing of the Armistice, 11 November, 1918. There had been years of passion, scorching, cold, and much despair, and anger heaving high, care whitely watching, sorrows manifold, among the young, among the weak and old, and the pensive spirit of pity whispered, 'Why?' Men had not paused to answer. Foes distraught pierced the thin peoples in a brute-like blindness. Philosophies that sages long had taught, and selflessness, were as an unknown thought, and hell and shell were yapped at loving-kindness. The feeble folk at home had grown full use to dugouts, snipers, Huns, from the war adept in the morning's herd, and at eve times perused, to day-dreamt men in millions when they mused, to nightmare men in millions when they slept. Waking to wish existence timeless, null, serious they watched above where armies fell. He seemed to check his flapping when, in the lull of night, a boom came thencewise, like the dull plunge of a stone dropped into some deep well. So, when old hopes that earth was bettering slowly were dead and damned, there sounded, 'War is done, one morrow,' said the bereft and meek and lowly, 'Will men some day be given to grace? Yea, holy, and in good sooth, as our dreams used to run.' Breathless they paused. Out there men raised their glance to where had stood those poplars lank and lopped, as they had raised it through the 4 years' dance of death in the now familiar flats of France, and murmured, 'Strange this. How? All firing stopped?' Aye, all was hushed. The about to fire fired not. The aimed at moved away in trance-lipped song. One checkless regiment slung a clinching shot and turned. The spirit of irony smirked out, 'What? Spoil peradventures woven of rage and wrong?' Thenceforth no flying fires inflamed the gray. No hurtling shook the dewdrop from the thorn. No moan perplexed the mute bird on the spray. Worn horses mused, 'We are not whipped today.' No weft-winged engines blurred the moon's thin horn. Calm fell. From heaven distilled a clemency. There was peace on earth and silence in the sky. Some could, some could not, shake off misery. The sinister spirit sneered, 'It had to be.' And again the spirit of pity whispered, 'Why?'"
Jacqueline, in the performance, you're going to have music of the era, but give us an idea of the mood or tone and set up this piece of music that we're going to hear.
Our performances, the program in our collaboration is very fluid until the very end, but at the moment we've been talking about pairing that poem with a very beautiful piece by Edward Elgar, an English composer. We know his whose music is still familiar to us. It's still played, and
at high school graduation.
And a thoughtful piece, Nimrod, that this was written in the 1890s, so it's a little bit anachronistic, but would have still been played in England then, and it just it starts with this almost. With very, very slow moving line, you can almost see a great plane, PLAIN, you know, mm-hmm. sort of opening out in front of you, this huge vista. And as the piece slowly chugs on, it's a beautiful music, but that in itself creates the sense of something really tragic. And there's a hushed moment in the middle of the piece where you just feel it's just ineffable, the whatever the emotion is. And this is not necessarily the emotion that Elgar had when he wrote the piece, but I think the emotion, it's not the circumstances, but I think the emotion still reads in that way. And then the piece, right towards the end, it builds up to a climax. Then there's this sudden, in music it's called subito piano, it just pulls back to as if you've just drawn in your breath, and the piece ends very quietly. And I'm thinking that could, as I get to know this poem a little better, and we're going to experiment with how we might surround the poem with that piece.
All right, so tell us a little bit about the piece that we're going to hear right now. This is not part of the performance, but sort of help us set the tone, if you will.
This is so I haven't yet recorded music that we've used for these programs, and in these programs I'm getting to really enjoy having my classical side come out of the closet, and so I'm getting to perform beautiful classical pieces, music hall pieces, and traditional music. I've been mostly known as a traditional pianist, but I've been really branching out in recent decades, and this particular piece we're going to hear is a Scottish air that actually dates back to the 18th century, and it's just very quiet. It won't have quite the grandeur of the Nimrod, but it will have some of the sense of just very quiet mourning.
Thank you.
really do get that sense of peace and quiet. Greg, did trench songs make it back into communities as soldiers returned home, or was it something soldiers were reticent to share given their experiences on the front? Do you know?
I think they came back mostly with expurgated lyrics. But there were some that were very popular among the troops, and you know, and they sang like people think of "It's a Long Way to Tipperary."
Oh,
that's
right.
The archetypal song, really, from World War One. Well, there's a reason for that, and that is that they really did sing that.
Yeah.
But so did people back home in Britain and Ireland and the U.S.
Jacqueline, how was the war and the experience of war reflected in the music that was being written for performance, say, in the music halls? What was happening in the music halls?
Well, I think certainly early in the war, you had this persistent optimism and excitement and, they said at the beginning of the war that we'll be home by Christmas and just so exuberant. But it's also just part of the music at the time too. I don't know musicologically speaking, if it's, you can separate out or the influence, but there's certainly, we're talking the ragtime era at the beginning of the war. The ragtime era was starting to slow down, but America had just in the 19th century formed its own music, but it was still influenced by music around from coming over from Europe. And then we had music going back the other way. James Reese Europe, African-American band leader, was in the armed forces and spread his ragtime. We've talked about maybe I'll play the Castle House rag. We haven't decided for sure. In Europe, there were beautiful classical compositions that reflected the horrible war deaths. And I might well play some pieces from Ravel's Le Tombeau du Couperin, which is a piano suite that's also been orchestrated. So people might have heard it in an orchestral version or a piano version. But the pieces were named after, in honor of friends of his who died in the war. And it sets up this irony, actually, because it's not grim music. The first piece, the prelude, sounds like champagne. This friend must have been one of these buzzy people who spoke fast and whose mind raced and probably very witty.
Yeah.
And it's just beautiful. And and then there is a quiet minuet, which we'll probably program, and we've done that. I've done that in previous programs of this. That's just beautiful and sweet and peaceful, but in the middle you hear these bells tolling, or at least that in my imagination that's what the purpose of it is. And so you start to get the sense again that the deaths of his friend was so hard that again he couldn't really talk about it.
And what's the waltz that we're going to hear now?
So now we're back to the sense
music halls,
of
right?
Music hall sound. And we're, I haven't recorded music of this era yet. I hope to sometime, but, a song that we're, considering for the program is a Tin Pan Alley song. It was copyright 1919. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Gay Paree?
I was going to say, and I think the point of this song is that the world has changed.
Mm-hmm.
We're not as insular anymore.
So this is just from one of my other recordings of 90s waltzes, which were popular and remained popular throughout and after World War One. But these are
a little bit later. Okay.
These are from, an earlier time. Thank you.
discussing the poetry and music of World War I. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the poetry and music of World War I with an eye toward the days leading up to the armistice. And with us is pianist Jacqueline Schwab and historian Gregory Williams.
Greg, you've described Wilfred Owen as perhaps one of the finest poets of World War I. He was a poet before he enlisted, so tell us more about him and his work, both before and during the service.
Well, yeah, he is the war poet, really. He was a poet before the war, as you pointed out. He was a teacher as well, and then he joined the army and went to the trenches, and that's when his poetry sort of really sharpened up. He also ended up in the same hospital in Scotland where Siegfried Sassoon, another very well-known war poet, was. And the two of them they became friends at this hospital, which was called Craig Lockhart. And Sassoon really assisted Owen in refining his poetry. Sassoon was even more bitter in his lines than Owen was, if you can imagine that. But he was. And then Owen ended up back in the fields of Flanders and France. Sassoon did not. And the great story, as far as I'm concerned, about Owen's life and the tragic story of his end is that he was killed the week before the armistice. Mm. And we always end the program. I say we always. This will be the third and probably final year of this program. But we always end with Owen's poem, the one I read last year here, Dulce et Decorum Est. Mm-hmm. And the end of his life is just such a story because the telegram was delivered to his, announcing his death, was delivered to his parents on Armistice Day as the bells of Armistice were ringing in their village. And there's a great biography of Wilfred Owen by another poet called John Stallworthy, and he describes that as the telegram they had dreaded for 3 years, and that's the day they got it.
Yeah.
Can I interrupt?
Another poem you'll be discussing in the presentation, Battle Lines, was written by Osbert Sitwell. Tell us more about him.
Sitwell is the complete opposite of Owen in a way. Sitwell was of a very wealthy family and a famous family. He was indeed a fifth baronet. And he was in the trenches and it was in the first battle of Ypres. How do you spell it? Y-R-P-E-S, something like that. I forget. The British called it wipers. But he was in the trenches and then came back and Sitwell lived until 1969 when he died in his villa in Italy. But a very colorful character. His brother, Sacheverell, was a writer, and his more famous sister was Dame Edith Sitwell, who people might have heard of, a real colorful woman who went around sort of dressed in medieval clothing and wrote poetry, too. So
yeah, and you have a poem of his, The Next War. Are you going to read that for us?
I do. This one's pretty bitter. It's called The Next War, and it's by Sir Osbert Sitwell. The long war had ended. Its miseries had grown faded. Deaf men became difficult to talk to. Heroes became bores. Those alchemists who had converted blood into gold had grown elderly. But they held a meeting, saying, "We think perhaps we ought to put up tombs or erect altars to those brave lads who were so willingly burnt, or blinded, or maimed, who lost all likeness to a living thing, or were blown to bleeding patches of flesh for our sakes. It would look well, or we might even educate the children." But the richest of these wizards coughed gently, and he said, "I have always been to the front, in private enterprise. I yield in public spirit to no man. I think yours is a very good idea, a capital idea, and not too costly. But it seems to me that the cause for which we fought is again endangered. What more fitting memorial for the fallen than that their children should fall for the same cause?" Rushing eagerly into the street, the kindly old gentleman cried to the young, "Will you sacrifice through your lethargy what your fathers died to gain? The world must be made safe for the young." And the children went.
Mm.
So, Greg, in the poem, the tombstone thing, the places you're talking about in that poem, this prompted some tourism, some people wanting to see these places. What happened?
Well, that was a phenomenon that had started really back at the time of the Napoleonic Wars in the early part of the 19th century, where people, for instance, wanted to see the Plains of Waterloo. And it happened again after our Civil War, and it happened again after World War I. Particularly, people wanted to see the places where they had lost their loved ones, their family members, their sons, their brothers, their husbands. And so, yeah, there was tourism of the World War I battlefields, as there still is today.
Yeah, I've heard of friends who've been visiting the camps in Germany from World War II. And it's a strange phenomena, but I think it's very useful in terms of keeping the idea alive that we don't want to forget what happened.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not that I want to recite the poem directly or read the poem directly, but there is a poem directly on that subject called High Wood. Mm. It's not really clear who wrote it. It's credited to a man named Philip Johnstone, but that's believed to be a pseudonym. Mm. That's one of the poems we'll certainly do in this program.
Yeah. Do we know the music in the period after the war, if it reflected a similar sentiment that a return to war was inevitable, or a tone of melancholy reflecting on what had transpired, or beginning of what was happening at this time? Do we know?
Well, I think that you think of the end of World War I leading into the Lost Generation and the Jazz Age, which kicked up right at the beginning of the 1920s. It sort of illustrates, though, I think, the great disconnect between what soldiers were experiencing in the field and the way people at home, which, by the way, wasn't that far away. Soldiers, at least officers, for the most part, although not wholly, but people could go on leave from Flanders or France and go home and be in London that day, which must have been really disorienting.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And especially, and this is one of the great themes of Siegfried Sassoon, is, as in all wars, I guess, but again, it was especially pointed then because of the very short period of time. You don't understand what it's like. You have no idea. Your life in London is sort of going on with the music halls and all the rest of that, but you have no idea what's happening to us. And of course, it's, you know, the newspapers and the media are trying to keep everybody's spirits up while this horrendous death toll is rolling on. So the Jazz Age kind of came in, again, right after World War I, but that was probably mostly the birth of the culture in the cities,
right,
not the soldiers bringing it home.
Yeah.
I think in our music worldwide, as the 20th century has moved in, there's you can hear more of a sense of irony.
The great theme of World War I.
As we go forth. And yet there's always still sweet music that's concomitant with that. So it's strange and hard to separate out. But certainly the innocence of 19th century parlor songs disappeared.
Yes, yeah, so away. Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about this next piece that we're going to hear.
I've fallen in love with this very, very interesting children's song, a Yiddish children's song. I'm not sure yet if we'll use this in the program, by M.M. Morshavsky, who died in 1907. So again, we're talking before the war, but this is still sung by families. I've met many friends who grew up with their parents singing to them. And it's of a Eufen Prepeshek, of a rabbi, the religious figure, teaching the children. And the main thought of the poem in the song is study, 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 study. I'm not sure we'll use this, and it depends on a certain poem whether we might pair it with. But if we do, I could say that this is a theme of our collaboration, that of studying and just knowing what happened in the past. And there is a line in the song: sometimes the study is laced with tears.
We're talking about the poetry and music of World War I. We'll talk more after a break.
You want to tell me about the clock now?
Yes, the clock is about 200 years old.
Jennifer Gaines at the Woods Hole Public Library.
It's 4:57, though.
So, yes, I did set it a few minutes early. So if people are here and it's time for us to close, they'll know just a few minutes ahead of time that they have to leave. Time marches on.
You're listening to WCAI.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the poetry and music of World War I with pianist Jacqueline Schwab and historian Gregory Williams.
Greg, as you compare the music and poetry that came out of the First World War and the Second World War, are there striking similarities or differences in themes or composition that strike you?
I'm not sure I could get that specific, but it's well documented that the amount of high-quality poetry that came out of World War I was simply not matched in World War II. And that might be a result of the soldiers themselves, not to go all class conscious or anything, but a lot of the people who were especially junior officers in World War I were very highly educated and educated in the classics, Latin and Greek and that sort of thing. And they went on to become poets. If they weren't poets before World War I, they became poets during the actual fighting. And I don't think you see that kind of thing as much in World War II. It's a lot of people can name poets from World War I. They can name Wilfred Owen, maybe Siegfried Sassoon, Isaac Rosenberg. But people sometimes can draw a blank when it comes to World War II. And there are some great poets, particularly Americans. Carl Shapiro and the British side would be Keith Douglas, I would say.
So why do you think we are so captivated by the music and poetry of war?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I think that it probably has a complex answer, too. I think there's many people who do get taken up in the brilliance of it and the testosterone of it, really, or of wanting to win. And Greg has told me that even when people knew the armistice was going to happen, you were just talking about it this morning.
Right.
Go ahead, and you can
Well, what we were talking about was if there has to be one word to describe World War I, it's stupid. And that's not my original thought. Obviously, there are hundreds and hundreds of books written about this, and the overarching theme is that it was really kind of unnecessary. It all resulted from, as most people know, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and his wife in Sarajevo. And that was the trigger. But all these intertangling treaties and alliances, it all just started coming apart. And the whole continent of Europe just split apart from what might have been a common center before. But the end of the war, Armistice Day itself, and we sort of talked about how the word got out to the commanders and to the soldiers, even when it was known that the armistice was going to be effective as of 11 a.m., there were still battles going on, and there were still battles being initiated. 10:30 in the morning, let's go. We're going to, and the soldiers.
People wanting to make a name for themselves.
That happened a lot.
Make a name for it.
That happened a lot.
And who cares if the men, the frontline men, die? They're just cannon fodder.
Yeah. I need to pump up my resume, and we need to get another 100 yards here, so let's go.
But I think there is an attraction. It can be very seductive and our society really encourages it. The glamour of guns and tanks and armaments, and the men going over had no idea that the weapons had been modernized, but the way they were waging war was not modernized. Mm-hmm. So they were just, there was a high likelihood that they were going to be miserable, get lice and rats and live with them in mud and water and then die and with no glory at all. And that all their partners, there wouldn't be any men left for women to make babies with after the war, that they were just going to be decimated. But it's still seductive to us. And I would hope that we're going to present another view at this. But it is tremendously seductive for our culture. And then I think then there are also some people who do meditate on things and really say just that beautiful word at the end of the poem you read, why? Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing. It's the particularly that war. It's so poignant. Mm-hmm. I mean, the war itself is stupid, but the works that grew from it are so poignant. And also, you use the word, I don't think this can be said often enough in regard to World War I, the irony. Mm-hmm. And that's become sort of, there's a famous writer about the poetry of the war. His name was Paul Fussell, and he talks about that. That's the theme, and it's the theme that carried throughout the rest of the 20th century. Yeah. Irony.
So you're giving two performances of Battle Lines. You want to tell us anything more about the format? It's not going to be fluid right up to the last minute.
No.
Right?
No. We will have a program. And
it'll be completely improvised.
And what I love about what Greg has done, and he so delves so deeply into the history, is that he has offered handouts to the audience but made them optional. So you don't have to do homework you can just take it in. You can just take it in and meditate on it. But if you want to learn more, he's provided that information. And he's also, at least in the two previous programs we've done, we've made it, we've had a video running too of pictures of the poets and of the battlefields. And you can just, it's a chance to meditate on that and think about our lives now and what we want to, for our future.
All right, let's go out on some music. Jacqueline, what can you tell us about the piece we're going to go out on?
So this piece probably won't be in the show, but who knows? it's a spiritual, sometimes I feel like a motherless child and somebody intensely grieving about their separation. In the case of the slaves, they were immigrated without their permission being asked, and often sold away from their parents, and so they were separated. And I think that even though this is anachronistic, and I don't know if we'll do it this particular piece in the concert, I try to put into my performance, and I'm going cross-cultural because I grew up as a white woman, not as an African-American woman, and not as a slave, but still putting my feelings into what somebody might feel then. Mm.
Battle Lines will be performed at the First Congregational Church in Chatham on Saturday, November 10th at 4 p.m. and again on Sunday, November 11th at 4 p.m. in West Barnstable at the 1717 Meeting House. We'll post all program details at our website, capeandislands.org. Gregory Williams, Jacqueline Swab, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us. I love your show, and I feel very honored to be here, and thanks for helping us talk about it.
I'd have to echo that. Thanks so much.
Thanks. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.